A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Punk Rock MBA Podcast.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock MBA Podcast. Today's guest is Kevin Jordan from This Wild Life. If you have not heard of This Wild Life, the way that they describe it, I think is pretty great. Calls it the Hot Topic Mumford & Sons, which is pretty accurate. They're an acoustic duo that plays music that is not unlike Mumford & Sons, but they are part of the kind of Warped Tour sort of scene. I think the music is pretty great, but the reason that I wanted to have them on the show is because they're just very smart about how they approach the band as a business. And that is what we talk about on this show. From their beginnings as just an unknown local duo like everybody else to recording their first album and getting signed by Epitaph, and now most recently deciding to leave Epitaph and go indie again. So we talk about why they did all those things and how they did them, as well as a bunch of nitty-gritty stuff like merch and saving money on tours and all that kind of stuff. You know, I like to get into the nitty-gritty details, and we talk about all that stuff. Great conversation, as always. Super happy to have him on the show. If you enjoy this one, there's a few things that you can do to help us out. Number one, you can share the show on social media, whether that is Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or TikTok or Friendster or Orkut. We don't care. We appreciate all of it. Tag me, tag the guest, tag Deanna. The platforms don't really do a lot to help us spread the word about the show, so we really rely on you guys for that. Thank you very much to everyone who's been sharing it. Number two, if you want to buy some merch, that also helps. There's a link to that in the description. I just designed a bunch of stuff that I think is pretty cool. And number three, if you really, really want to support the show, then you can become a patron. Patrons get access to every episode a week early. There's an opportunity to have me review your band or podcast or YouTube channel or design portfolio or any other kind of project that you want to send my way if you want to hear what I think about it. So if that sounds interesting, there's a link to our Patreon in the show notes as well. And with that out of the way, let's get into the episode. Good morning, Kevin. Welcome to the podcast.
How's it going, dude?
This is where I put my podcast voice on. Good morning, Kevin. Welcome. Watch out for brake lights at the 405.
I do that in post-production. I pitch shift down, heavy compression, really dial in that narrator voice, that God voice.
Slam that limiter, scoop out all the mids.
Like a metalcore guitar.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I like. I mean, you can never really go wrong with scooped mids and a slammed limiter. I feel like that just makes, regardless of what source material you're working with, that always makes it sound better.
I'll give it a go.
At least that's what I think. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know about acoustic guitars. We'll see.
You got to limit the fuck out of those things. If your waveform doesn't look like a square, you're doing something, or a rectangle, you're doing something wrong with those acoustics.
Use your eyes instead of your ears while recording. I like that. It's a new one.
Exactly. That's my whole thing. Like, why spend a bunch of money on fancy monitors when all you really need is the right spectrum analyzer so you can just mix with your eyes?
I love it.
You just learned something. I just changed the game for you this morning. Cool. Well, I was doing some research this morning, and I thought it was pretty interesting the way you categorized yourself. The Hot Topic Mumford & Sons. I like that.
That came as a joke from one of our touring members from years ago. We were like literally setting up a stage at, I think it was at Stubbs in Austin, and he was just kind of bagging on us and came up with that slogan, and we loved it so much that now we've completely adopted it. It's in all the bios. It's how we refer to ourselves on stage now. So I think it's pretty accurate.
It's funny, but it is accurate, and it's actually great branding. Like with startups, you know, you always want to say like, oh, it's like Uber for X or it's like Spotify for Y, and people instantly get it.
Oh, I've never thought of it that way. We always just find it to be like a funny joke to be part of banter on stage.
It is funny.
But I've never thought of it as a pitch.
But it's actually really good.
Yeah.
Like Siler's Tour Limp Bizkit, you know?
That's your business mind working. I'm just a songwriting dummy.
Yeah. We could talk about whatever you want, because you're a smart guy, but I thought it might be interesting to talk about
how you got signed and kind of the process of that, because, you know, you guys are an Epitaph, great label that everybody loves. I think lots of people would love to be in your shoes. And I thought that might be an interesting conversation. So tell me how that happened. I read your bio there. I don't want you to have to repeat yourself too much, but tell me how you ended up getting on Epitaph's radar.
The band started off as like what was supposed to be a 5-piece pop punk band. We had another singer. I was writing the songs. For my first time playing guitar in a band, I always played drums growing up. That singer quit after we recorded our first EP before we ever released anything. And we tried out singers for a year. Nobody stuck. And the rest of the guys in the band basically just forced me to sing. And put out one EP, like a 5-song EP that was pop punk. The second EP we did was half acoustic, half full band. And we kind of just grinded as a local band for years. And legitimately every label in the scene and management company, every booking agent passed on us. We got some nice no's from people and a lot of, you know, non-returned emails as the industry goes. But we didn't get any attention at all until we decided to go fully acoustic. And while we were in the studio making our first record, Clouded, which we did on our own independently, Epitaph hit us up literally on a Facebook message, which seemed like it wasn't even legit at the time, but
right
over 5 years later, and we released 3 records with them. In fact, our last record was our last album on our contract with Epitaph, and we've just made kind of like a scary decision to go back to being an independent band and own our own masters and be able to steer our own ship, which honestly, to be fair with Epitaph, we always had complete creative direction. They signed us before they even heard our first album. They just liked what we were doing. Brett at Epitaph is obviously a musician himself, and I think he respects the people that he works with enough to let them make their own records, make their own art, you know. So we've never had any pushback with single choices, album artwork, titling, anything like that at all. You know, it's not like the old major label machine of having somebody breathe down your neck while you're in the studio, or some guy showing up with a bag full of coke or something like that. You know, it's like, he was always really, really supportive. So, you know, we're moving on, but we have nothing but good things to say about that label. And I grew up in Southern California, you know, and it's like, I grew up as a 90s kid. So that era of music that was on the radio, you know, bands like Offspring, Rancid, Bad Religion, that was so massive. And for us to sign to them was like, I say not even a dream come true, because I didn't think that was possible.
Right.
Like, I always looked at them as so much higher above anything that I could have hoped for. So it was surreal, like going and getting sandwiches with Brett and going over to his house for cookies and milk around Christmas and stuff. It's just like, it's bizarre. You know, sometimes I talk to my other member, Anthony, and I just like go, do you think about, like, if I would have told you, you know, 5 years ago that we'd be sitting here making an album with Epitaph, having dinner over with his wife and kids at the house, like, would you have believed me if I told you that was possible? You know, and it's cool to reflect on that kind of stuff.
Well, I don't know him, but he emailed me when I don't know if you saw it, but I made a video about when they signed Lil Lotus, and I made a video talking about kind of why I was so supportive of Epitaph signing those artists. And he emailed me like the next morning and was like, oh, I saw the video, it was great. If you're ever in LA, you should come, or if you're in LA, come to the Christmas party at Epitaph tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I wish I was.
Yeah, they throw great Christmas parties. Like, they get like a taco truck and rent out like a karaoke bar in LA, and it's always a really fun time.
Yeah, the reason I was asking about that is because I think people have a lot of, and I want to talk about why you made the decision to go indie and all that, because that's a whole other topic I'd love to hear more about. But there's this idea that people have that labels are like these evil, like, you know, like the Emperor Palpatine from behind the scenes, like manipulating the poor musicians into doing all these terrible things they don't want to do and stealing all their money and all this. And that does happen, that has happened, but like, people that work at labels work there because they love music and they love the artists they work with. Like, nobody's gonna go work for a label for the money, because there isn't any.
Yeah, I was gonna say, from what I can tell, there's not a whole lot of money on that side anyways. Maybe, you know, if you own a record label,
maybe
that's different, but if you're an employee of a label, yeah, I think those people are, the majority of them are doing it for the right reasons. And, you know, it's like, I think the stereotype of like the slimeball A&R guy is in my experience, hasn't been something that I've ran into, you know, and we've worked with a handful of A&R guys. So
I've never, again, I'm sure this has happened, but I have never personally heard anybody tell me like that the label forced them to do something with their music. You know, they may have suggestions or something like that, but you know, lots of times if a band puts out a record that people don't like, the fans say, oh, it's because the label made them do it. And well, first of all, good fucking luck getting a musician to do anything they don't want to do. Like, it's right. Just not gonna fucking happen.
Now, in my experience, the musicians are always the ones that, like, people always think like, oh, they signed to this label and they went all commercial and watered down their music and stuff. In my experience, from every conversation I've had with other bands, is it's always their decision to do it. They're not pushed to do it. I think everybody, especially scene bands, and we've been guilty of it at times too, we feel like, what's the next move? What's the next move? Where, how do we get out? How do we break out? How do we, like, you know, keep one foot in and put another foot out into the mainstream world? How do we go alternative? How do we do this? You know, for metalcore bands, how do we go butt rock? How do we get on active rock festivals and active rock radio? And, you know, I always just say, like, I don't see a lot of examples of that working, you know, and there's always going to be the exception to the rule. Sure. You're always going to have some breakout band that is able to cross over. But I think everybody points to them and try to imitate it, but there's no formula for that stuff. And it's such a crapshoot, you know, because our band is kind of interesting in the way that, like, our music is essentially kind of mom rock, but we exist in this more like Warped Tour world, or what used to be a Warped Tour world.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've thought at times like, well, why don't we have a shot at having, you know, an acoustic song at AC radio? Why don't we have a shot at this or that? And it's never been because the label has been pushing us to say, hey, we really need a song that sounds like, you know, Perfect by Ed Sheeran from you guys. You know, it's like, that's never in an independent record label scene. That's just not happening.
It's not how it works. Well, that said, it is interesting to me. I mean, you called it mom rock. You have a very clear, like, sense of who you are and what the band sounds like. You know, you're self-deprecating, but by the same token, you obviously take your music very seriously and you put a lot of love and care into it. How is the reaction to, I mean, everyone I've ever heard likes your music, but is there ever a time where people in the Warped Tour world are kind of like, what are you doing here?
No, I think for the most part, it's like, we wouldn't exist in that world. Like, I guess legitimately, probably if we didn't have tattoos, you know, it's like, we probably wouldn't exist in this world. Maybe we would be opening up for Ryan Cabrera tours in 2020 or something like that. But everybody's always been super open to us. And, you know, we've done tours where, you know, we've played right before Beartooth. We've done tours where we played right before Turnstile. And it's never been a problem, you know? And it's like, you know, we did a tour with Newfound Glory years ago that was Turnover, Us, Turnstile, and Newfound Glory. And it was like such a mixed bill.
Yeah.
And I always, as a kid growing up, I always found that really refreshing when I went to shows. I remember a tour that was like Emery, Gatsby's American Dream, Gym Class Heroes, and As Cities Burn. I was like, what the hell is going on here? Like, feels like you're walking into different clubs throughout the night. But I always found it refreshing. So I think in general, a lot of bands like bringing out a band like us. A, because it's really simple to bring out two dudes that aren't going to take up a bunch of room or a bunch of the catering budget. And B, because, you know, it just brings variety to a show. And I think a lot of bands think about not only ticket sales, but they think about, like, how do we deliver a cool, unique experience to our fans? And as a support band for us, that's, for the most part, been a benefit to us.
There's an interesting thing there, which is, like, that I think a lot of artists, musicians, but, you know, artists of any kind, think that by playing it safe and doing the thing that everyone else is doing, that's what's going to get them traction. Well, let's just do the proven thing that we know works. We'll just copy that thing everyone else is doing, play it safe. We don't want to rock the boat, but actually doing something radically different is the thing that is going to get you traction.
Yeah, we've always, like, maintained the idea of it's better to stand out than to fall in line. So if we were to go out there and just do nothing but acoustic tours, we wouldn't stand out at all.
Right.
You know, and it's, so it's like when you see a band come on stage at a pop punk show or a screamo show that is like, what? Hold on. There's only two of them. Like, they're not just setting up, they're playing already, you know? And people are kind of caught off guard. And for us in the like the live show experience, it's been really beneficial. And I always kind of describe it like, usually when you go see a live band in a club, the sound is so shitty that you can't understand a single word the singer is saying. It's kind of just like, do you like the vibe of it? If you do, check out the record, because there's no way you're going to walk away knowing really what happened after a live set. But with us, there's so little going on that we're able to communicate our songs in a way that other bands don't have the opportunity to live. So it's been beneficial.
You do have some instrumentation in your arrangements that you're not going to be able to do with two people live. And I know, like in your bio, you emphasized that you only wanted to do instruments that, you know, you could physically play. What do you do with those arrangements live? Do you not play those songs? Do you use backing tracks? What do you do?
A combination. So it's, you know, we've always played to backing tracks. Actually, before we did it before our first Warped Tour, we started playing with a backing track of just bass to fill out our choruses, which in retrospect was a really great decision, because when Attila is playing the next stage over from you and you're just playing acoustic guitars, like you can't cover up their sound with the sound that you're making. And over the years, we've gotten more liberal with that. Like, oh, well, we have a string arrangement on this song and it's beautiful. Why wouldn't we use this, or keys and stuff? And so now we've gotten to the point where we're like, we're not scared to use a backing track live, you know? And it's like, I think at the early stages of the band, I was like ashamed of it, you know, for certain things. But then it was like, I would go and see a band like 21 Pilots and I go, what an incredible fucking experience. I do not care that there's two dudes up there and there's this wall of sound. I just don't care. It's like, I want to see these guys perform these songs that they made. And so, yeah, we use backtracks for a lot of things. This last touring cycle really is when we became the hot topic Mumford & Sons. We like had a whole busking setup where I'm playing kick drum live and Anthony's playing, has like a floor tom with a beater hitting the bottom of it and a hi-hat. And he plays mandolin live. He plays electric guitar, you know, bass, keys, like, we'd really move around and do as much as we can.
I feel like I'm in an Anthropology commercial.
Yeah, we do as much as we possibly can to like represent that sound. And like I said before, that the guy who coined the term Hot Topic, Mumford & Sons, he's toured with us off and on over the years as like a third member playing keys, bass, vocals, whatever we need him to do. But now we have actually our merch dude comes on stage and plays electric guitar on songs where Anthony plays drums. So we do as much as we can. And then the rest of it is held up by the good old MacBook Pro.
Right. So you mentioned something earlier that I thought was interesting about like having the one foot in, one foot out kind of thing, where bands in the Warped Tour scene are always kind of looking for what's that other opportunity, the grass is always greener, and then making musical compromises to make that happen. But as you said, you don't really have to make any musical compromises for that to happen. Like, you guys are culturally like super in the Warped Tour world, but musically you could be on mainstream radio tomorrow. Are you looking for that next thing, or do you want to stay in the Warped Tour world, or how do you think about that?
Genuinely, we think about it less and less, honestly. And radio has always been like a pipe dream for me. And everyone that we've ever talked to just says, focus on your art, focus on, instead of trying to widen your audience, focus on trying to deepen your mm-hmm. audience. So like, how do you have a more resonating, a more meaningful connection with the people that love what you do already? It's so much harder to engage a casual music listening audience. Like I always say, like the people that come to this wildlife shows, they are not casual fans. You know, it's like if 300 or 500 people show up for this wildlife show, or 100 people show up, they all know the deep tracks. You know, like we just did a show in January where we played our first album and our newest album front to back. And it's like, you know, playing a handful of songs that we've never played live before. And I was just blown away. I'm like, these people know track 8 from an album that came out, you know, 5 years ago. And they know track 9 on a fresh album from a band that's been out for over 5 years. Like, so we have this fan base that is really engaged, and from what I've seen is they are not as much of a singles audience as they are, like, they're listening to our full records, like our full records stream pretty well. So we don't really focus on radio and stuff anymore. And I think playlisting obviously is kind of like where everybody's shifting their focus to these days, because it's a little easier to attain. There's more room, you know, there's not a whole lot of room for new artists on radio, but there's a huge amount of room for new artists on playlisting. And the interesting thing is that we got a couple years ago, we got like this massive acoustic playlist on Spotify, and it got us a lot of plays, and it didn't really generate a grassroots audience. You know, we were touring throughout that whole period. And I legitimately remember one instance in which somebody said specifically that they found us off this playlist. And it was the funniest fucking thing because I'm standing at the exit, like schlepping CDs on a Dashboard Confessional tour after the show. And this woman walks up to me and she goes, "Oh my gosh, I have to buy your CD." And she pulls out her phone. She goes, "I have your song downloaded and I didn't know that you guys were on this tour and I didn't know who you were until you closed with that song." And I'm just, and I like kind of cracked up. I'm like, so it works, but it doesn't work because this woman has listened to our song 100 times and had no fucking clue who we were, didn't follow us on social media to know we would even be on the tour, and then had clearly never even seen us because we're playing a whole set on stage. And she said, "I didn't recognize you until the last song."
Yeah. I'm not surprised though, because I mean, I listen to sometimes, you know, upbeat coffee shop vibes or whatever kind of playlist. And I like it. It's great. But I have no idea who any of those artists are. Or like, I don't know if you've seen that like joke tweet that goes around sometimes, you know, the scary thing about chain smokers is any two white guys could walk past you on the street and it could be them and you'd never know.
I would know because I just went with my mom to a chain smokers concert last year. So I know who they are.
Well, you might know. But the point is, I think that in your genre, more so than in, say, metalcore, there are those casual fans that might listen to a song a million times and have no idea who it's by and not care.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot, how some of our stuff is like kind of mood music. You know, it's like I've heard Explosions in the Sky maybe 1,000 hours in my life. I don't know who the fuck those guys are.
Yeah.
You know, if they, you know, they could be the Chainsmokers. You know, I would have no clue. So there is an aspect of that to softer music for sure. And I think early on, I was almost offended by that when people would say like, "Oh, I love to put on your music to fall asleep to." I'm like, "Oh, shit, is that boring? Really?" You know, like, but now I kind of get it, you know, and I utilize soft music for relaxation and stuff too. So I think it's really cool to like kind of serve that purpose in a way. And we've made records that are really full, but you know, like the new record that we're making right now is that we're really focusing on making the most beautiful acoustic songs that we can. We're trying to not go too crazy with arrangement. We're not, you know, layering in huge bass synths and stuff to try to make a really full sound. We're kind of trying to draw the listener in, have it be more intimate. So I think we're kind of leaning more into that these days than anything.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are the Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like, I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
One of the things you mentioned also was being a duo rather than a full band and how there's kind of some logistical and financial benefits to that. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the big obvious glaring one is obviously there's less money to be split between people. So financially, our band from an early stage was able to be full-time where a lot of other bands wouldn't be able to be full-time. They'd have to work jobs at home intermittently. But, you know, it's ups and downs. So the downside of that is there's less people to delegate work to. So because of that, Anthony and I...
Wait, that implies that all members of a band do shit. You know better than that.
I pride myself on being like the opposite of the stereotypical singer who just like shows up with the SM57 in his back pocket to a show. I never want anybody to think that, you know, that I've taken our opportunities for granted. So I'm like, I think it's something that I learned through kind of the Warped Tour ethic of like all hands on deck and everybody needs to hustle. And I just never want to be seen with nothing in my hands or like I'm just fucking along for the ride or something. Like I want to know for myself that I earned it, and I want other people to see that. And I don't care for like the recognition of it, but like I think people need to see like not just the highlights. People need to see that it's work. And like we've never been the type to try to glamorize what we do, like fake that we're bigger than we are or anything. Like we fucking sleep in the van on tour still, you know. And could we afford not to? Absolutely. But we choose to come home with more money, right, so that we could have comfortable lives. We're each married with dogs and houses. So we need to, you know, feed ourselves. And we really, really have focused on being extremely self-sufficient. So, you know, I am our tech. I am our lighting engineer. I do all of our stage production and run all of our sound live. And Anthony is our tour manager. We drive ourselves. We have one person that travels with us who is our merch dude. He kind of guitar techs for us in between songs. And like I said before, he'll come up and play a couple songs during our set. We've really shifted into this place of everybody needs to have multiple jobs, because none of these things by themselves are really justifiable to have another mouth to feed or another ass in a seat of the van. So instead of being more comfortable on a tour, let's sleep less and earn a little bit more, and let's really invest in not only in our knowledge, but like just like the gear. You know, it's like we see other bands that go out there and rent things that they could be buying, right, and in one tour they could have paid it off, and then every tour after that, you know, would have amounted to savings. So it's like, you know, it's just, I think a lot of bands, some of them are lazy, like what you were just mentioning. And I think the other half of that is people want perception, and like the whole idea of perception is reality if you look big. And I get that too. And I've always looked at it like
there's some truth to that.
There is, but the perception of your stage performance is different than the perception of being on a bus or the perception of having a big crew, which your fans don't fucking know about. You know, if you have a 10 guy crew, nobody knows.
Here's the move. I'm going to tell you this. Anybody listening, take notes. Just get your own empty road case and just haul that around everywhere so it looks like you're helping out, but you're not. It's like, oh, yeah, I'll be right back, guys. I just got to take this over there, and then just keep walking around with your empty road case until everyone's finished loading in.
Is this how you snuck into shows when you were younger or what? You just like invested in one road case instead of concert tickets?
See, and it pays back in just a few shows.
It's not a bad bet.
But in all seriousness, I really like the way you're talking about this, because it's the same way that you think about like any small business, which is what a band is. Like if you're opening a mom and pop pizza shop, you don't hire somebody to clean the tables because it makes you look like a baller. You do it yourself because you can't afford another person.
Yeah.
Do you know who Dave Weckl is by any chance, the jazz guy?
Yes.
So I remember reading one of his solo albums years ago. he wrote a little like thing in the liner notes, like, well, you might notice a few changes about this album, one of which is that we no longer have a guitar player. Part of that is because it isn't part of the sound we envisioned, but a large part of that is also due to the economic realities of touring as a five piece. And I was like, dude, if Dave Weckl has to fire his fucking guitarist because he can't, I mean, Dave Weckl is a fucking legend. One of the most
drummer, right?
Yeah, one of the most famous like jazz drummers of all time. And if Dave Weckl has to fire his guitarist because he can't afford it, that tells you something.
Yeah, I don't know the ins and outs of the jazz industry. My place has been a little different than that. But
the point being is like mouths to feed is really what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see bands now that like when they lose a member, they just go, we aren't not replacing that member, you know, because they start to see after years of being on the road, you know, like for instance, State Champs, they just lost their guitarist. And they're like, we're moving forward as a four piece.
Periphery replaced Nolly with a MacBook.
Yeah. And it's like less mouths to feed, but, you know, less ways to split any of the profits. You know, I always look at it like with our band, you know, let's say on if we get paid $100 for a show, which has happened in the past, you got 15% away to your management, 10% away to your booking agent, and 5% to your business management. So you have 30% right off the top.
Right.
So that $100 turns into 70. Split it between however many fucking members you have in your metalcore band or your two-piece acoustic band, and then take 30% away. So I look at it, you know, it's like I'm really only making $30 per every, you know, 30% of what we make as a two-piece band.
Right.
Turn that into a five-piece band, and my God, it's like I look at it and I go, how do these dudes survive?
And then you're paying taxes on that 30%.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's not the best business venture. Like if you want to earn money, picking up a guitar is not the fucking way to do it.
No, it's not. However, I am inspired by people like Johnny Frank or Shinigami and lots of these other people who make a full-time living off of streaming. And, you know, they're not getting rich, but they are paying the bills off of streaming versus a lot of bands who complain about streaming. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of which is that they've given up their publishing. The other is that they have five people to split it with.
Yeah.
And so when I look at kind of the model for the future, it looks a lot more like what you guys are doing, like two hardworking people who actually bust their ass and contribute value, as opposed to one or two people in a band that does everything and then three people that fucking sit around and don't do much other than maybe show up and play bass in the studio, or more likely the guitarist tells them to go home and plays their parts for them.
That reminds me of the Vandals DVD where the bass player finds out that he's like, when I would leave the studio after tracking my parts, the guys would be like, oh, you mind leaving your bass so we can fuck around? He's like, and I know that when I'd come back the next day, there was different parts recorded than what I had played.
I mean, if you have Warren Fitzgerald in the band, you should just have him play your shit.
Yeah, let him do it.
Yeah. But my point is, like, if you want to make a living off of this shit, narrowing it down to one or two people who will really contribute a lot just makes financial sense. And I understand people maybe don't like the creative implications of that. And I guess to them, I would say, well, it's up to you. I mean, that's a trade-off you need to make. Do you want to have an acoustic drummer in your band? Or are you okay with programmed drums? Either one is fine, but you have to understand there's a trade-off there between creatively what you want to do and another mouth to feed.
Yeah, for sure. It's, you know, I look at like bands like Beartooth, where Caleb is the creative force of that band. And then he brings in these guys to create what his vision in the live experience. And it's like, there are benefits to that. But like, you know, if it's done right, like those guys are all very well taken care of. They're all fucking super happy to be playing in that band. And Caleb is not only a super talented dude, but he's just a really sweet, sweet person. Yep. And so they're happy to be that support role. For me, I've always been more of like a control freak, and it would be much, much harder for me to just kind of show up and clock in that way, you know, but people are just created differently. And like in our band, Anthony, he doesn't care as much about artistic direction when it comes like to actual physical art. Our music, he's very invested in, but like, he doesn't care what shirt designs what stupid shit I come up with. He doesn't care what, you know, I title the album.
Or maybe more accurate to say that he trusts you with it.
Yeah.
Cause he cares. Like if something shitty came out, I'm sure he wouldn't be happy about it.
He would be unhappy with it if he saw that we had a bunch of inventory in it and it didn't sell.
Right. So he's trusting you with it.
He's very business minded.
Don't fuck up our merch designs.
Yeah, for sure. It's about the delegation and finding, you know, it's like I am just not a great numbers dude. I am business minded to a degree, but I'm never, ever going to get into the nitty gritty of analytics, of inventory. Any of that shit is just not going to be my thing. I'm not going to go over gas receipts and figure out ways to pinch pennies in that way. My thing is always, well, what kind of ways can we save? Like, it's so much harder to just like increase your fan base, increase all of your income. But there are so many ways that you could cut down on costs. And that's always been my place in the businesses. Hey, you know what? I really think that we should, on this first headline tour, we should come out straight away with production. Let me spend $1,000 on lights and figure out how to do this and so that we can have production in these small clubs where bands normally don't have it. And I go, it's $1,000. I know right now that doesn't sound like a great idea, but people are spending so much money every single tour doing this stuff. And we still own, you know, 5 years later, we've invested a lot more in production over the years, but we still own some of those lights that we bought on the very first tour. And some of them we've upgraded or they've broken or whatever, but we continue to utilize things that we bought for tours 4 years ago and today's shows.
Hopefully they're fully depreciated on your taxes.
That's another one where I don't know shit about that.
You can write off the depreciation of all that shit that you bought every year.
Really early on, we took on a business manager, even though, you know, a lot of bands that are smaller don't even bother. But we just heard horror stories about bands that didn't pay taxes for years. And then, you know, 3 years later, after touring full time and having a big single out and having all this income, that they just spent every dollar they had having fun. And, oh, you know, IRS knocks on the door and you owe $250,000. So now your next entire year and a half of work is for fucking nothing.
Yeah.
Fuck, you know, just, man, to get even.
Dude, if anybody listening to this, do not fuck around with your taxes. Pay someone to do them for you. It is worth it. That person will save you more money than whatever you're paying them. And most importantly, you're going to be a lot less likely to end up in the fucking crosshairs of the IRS, which is not fucking fun.
Yeah. They're good people. That we talk with them on a weekly basis about bills that are coming in, everything. And like, the cool part about it is that if we're owed money, we don't have to hunt people down, you know. And that happens a lot in the music industry where you're owed things. A lot of times we owe other people and they're hunting us down for merch debt or whatever, but they go after these people and make sure that we're paid every last dollar. And it's that pays for itself to me.
So with all of that being said, I mean, you guys clearly understand the value of bringing together a team. You understand delegation and all that stuff. Why did you choose to go independent? And I don't want to say cut the label out, because that sounds, you know, negative, and I don't mean it that way, but you've chosen to part ways with that part of your team. What was that all about?
Like I said earlier, we had a 3-album deal with Epitaph, and our last record fulfilled that last record on the contract. And moving forward, they sent us a re-up offer, said, hey, do you want to do one more with us? You know, and gave us the full budget of the last record. We've recouped all three of our records over the years, and we've performed well in their system.
What does that mean for anybody who doesn't know? Recouping.
Your label gives you a budget to make a record. Recouping just means that that album has been paid off. So that debt that you took on for that record budget or advance or whatever, usually you get like a full budget. And if you don't spend all that money to make the record, you get the rest of it in cash. So we have paid off all of those records through album sales and streaming.
Which means then you start making royalties on them.
Yeah, you do receive royalties, like a small mechanical royalty for all records sold even prior to that record being paid off or recouped. But yeah, after that, then you start actually seeing checks that are significant rather than, you know, the classic like ASCAP 12 cent check or something like that. Yeah, it was just a decision where we said, well, we have performed well in their system, but what do we see that a label has done for us that we can't do on our own? And there are bands that I think probably need that more than others. Mm-hmm. But we look at it and we said, well, our first record, we spent $10,000 on it, our own, to make it, and it performed really well. It ended up sounding really good. We got a good guy to mix it. And our second record, I think we tripled that budget. We spent like $30,000 on it. Our last record, we spent $100,000 on it. We went to,
dude, that is a monster budget these days.
Yeah, we went to a Grammy award-winning producer, this guy named Ryan Hadlock.
Okay.
You're in Washington. So he's up there. Do you know Bear Creek Studios?
Yeah. Yeah, we live right by there, actually.
Yeah, so we just made our record there, Petaluma, a couple years ago. And, you know, we went to him because he did, like, the Vance Joy record. He did the Lumineers record. We're like, let's go to an acoustic guy, you know? And it's like, and to be fair, we didn't even know who the fuck he was. We don't really listen to a whole lot of that stuff. But when we did, we were like, holy shit, listen to these records this guy's making. Like, there's something special going on here. And we're like, we didn't think we'd be able to get him. And Epitaph helped us. And they said, yeah, we'll fork over the money to put you guys in there with somebody special like that. Let's do it.
For comparison, there's like plenty of like bands on, say, Rise or Century Media or something doing records for 10 grand. So
yeah,
to spend 100 on an acoustic album is a crazy huge budget.
Yeah. I mean, we went in there and we brought in, I think we ended up having like 5 different additional players on it, you know, horn players, keys, stand up bass, full strings, like the whole nine. You know, we really, really went deep with it. And it was scary for us because I have always heard horror stories of like the band that goes and records with Rick Rubin, but they're really just working with his, you know, his assistant, and he never shows up and doesn't care. And so I thought, well, we're not a big band. This guy's, you know, fucking making Lumineers records. He's not going to give a shit about us. And I couldn't have been more wrong. He showed up every single day and was so focused. And like, that dude just loves his job and is really good at what he does. So we ended up having this great experience. The record turned out awesome. And we look back at it and we go, holy shit, we learned so much being a part of that process that we liked. And we've had other processes where we learned what we didn't like and what we did like as well. And with all of that experience this whole time, I have been a sponge. And I just like, I have watched what they do. I've seen the gear that they use to find a great sound for my acoustic guitar, for my vocal. And I've always demoed stuff from, you know, 10 years ago, I bought my first Pro Tools rig, and now I've become far more proficient at recording. And what we do is I don't need a gigantic space to record drums. I don't need, you know, 30 channels to, you know, and a million microphones to capture a fucking Terry Bozzio drum kit or something. Yeah. I can do what I need to do in a bedroom. And that was a big part of us saying, well, do we need to spend $100,000 on the next record for it to be a beautiful record that really speaks? And the answer was no. We just said, well, we didn't spend that much on the first record and we love that record.
Yep.
So we love the third record, but we spent 10 times as much on it, legitimately, and that, you know, and then more than that on the end of marketing it and creating music videos and all these things. So we just looked at, do we need to take a budget from a label to make a record these days? And the answer is no. You know, we invested in our own gear to record at our homes. Anthony lives in Utah, I live here in Phoenix, and we just email song ideas back and forth constantly.
This is the model to me, is like just 100% self-contained DIY thing. You outsource the parts you need to, for example, your business manager. You're not going to do your taxes yourself, but the creative part, you can do that all yourself, especially for your kind of music. There's no reason. I mean, I'm sure that Ryan Hadlock did an amazing job, but to your point, do you need to spend 100 grand? Probably not. And there's no reason why anybody in, you know, 2020 can't record their music at home to the level that it sounds as good as anything on any album that you've heard. There's absolutely no reason, you know, especially if you get...
Yeah, agreed. And we always just say, fix it when you mix it. You know, it's like, I know that the sounds that I'm going to get going into the computer, capturing my acoustic guitar, are not going to be as good as what Ryan Hadlock does with hundreds of thousands of dollars of vintage gear and his ears and his knowledge. But what I know is that when we send our record off to be mixed, that guy's going to be able to fix some of the fuck ups that I did on the way in, you know? And it's like,
I was going to say the opposite. I was going to say practice so that it sounds good on the way in, but that works too.
Well, yeah, that's definitely part of it, you know? And that's something that we've been really honing our skills on in this last year, just in the demoing process alone, is where we've just said, let's take this more seriously. Let's see how much better we can get at this, at capturing what we do. And, you know, it's like, I'll be on FaceTime with Anthony telling him like, oh, try this positioning with your new condenser mic to capture your acoustic guitar, make it brighter and this and that. And that all of that stuff is super important. And I see a lot of people in the industry that when they are around people with knowledge that they just look at it like, oh, he's got it. And they don't pay attention.
Yeah.
And that's what I talked about earlier, being that sponge, is that I am constantly in this industry surrounded by people that have been doing what they've done for decades, being around people that are super fucking talented. And I am just a curious motherfucker. I never stop asking questions. We produce our own music videos now. And we, through YouTube, if you have enough subscribers, you get access to what's called the YouTube space in LA or New York, where mm-hmm. they have these huge sound studios and you have access to rent for free all of this insane fucking camera gear. I'm like holding a shoulder cam with like $150,000 worth of shit on my shoulder.
Right.
I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I'm just asking questions.
Where's the record button?
When I find somebody that works there that knows what they're doing, bro, I couldn't like attach the fucking the camera to the mount. I had to YouTube how to do it while I was at YouTube to figure out how to hook up a Sony Red cam.
But you did it. That's the important part.
But we fucking did it, you know? And at the end of it, you look at the video, you go, holy shit, it looks like somebody kind of knew what they were fucking doing. We did it, you know? And it's like,
because you had the willingness to just jump in and go, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, but here we go. I'm going to figure it out.
That's the one thing. It's like, I know This Wild Life isn't the greatest fucking band in the world, but we have always been fearless when it comes to like taking on opportunities, not being scared to get our hands dirty or to try things that other people haven't done. We're never too cool to go sell our own CDs or be part of every little detail of the process. Like, we really, really try and understand our business as a whole and everything that we can do to take the load ourselves so that we can profit more off of it. And at the end of everything, like when I look back at like a live video of us playing, like I have so much more gratification knowing that like we did that our fucking selves. And like I'm sitting there watching lighting cues on the thing, not even paying attention to what I was singing mm-hmm. because I'm so like invested in everything that we're doing. And the gratification of all of that is just amplified because of how deep we've gotten into everything that we do.
Well, that sounds like a great place to end it to me. I love that. Like, that is exactly the way that I think every creator should think about whatever it is that they do. Like, you have to care about all of it and you have to put everything you've got into all of it and take ownership of it. That's the model. Like, everyone has the tools to do it. So that is what I would suggest anybody takes away from this if you're listening. Any words of wisdom or stuff you want to plug or anything before I let you go?
Words of wisdom, I'd say, like I said before, be a sponge when you're around people that are talented and knowledgeable, if they're willing. I mean, don't be a complete pain in the ass, but be as much of a pain in the ass as you can, you know,
yes.
In circumstances. And I guess this year, yeah, we're making our fourth full-length record. It's going to be coming out later this year. And, you know, I hope people check it out.
Cool. Well, thanks again for doing this, and definitely let me know next time you find yourselves in Seattle.
Cool. Thanks, Finn.
All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask? Good morning.
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to the show on the road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.